From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. The Capitol is on high alert today because of a threat from far-right groups, including followers of the QAnon conspiracy. Those extremists claim Donald Trump will retake the presidency today. This is not stopping the Senate from carrying on. The House adjourned, but not before Democrats passed two major bills last night, one on voting rights, the other on police reform. For more, we're joined by NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. And Sue, Democrats have railed against bills passed in state houses across the country that would make it harder to vote, curbing things like mail-in voting and early voting that were expanded last year during the pandemic. So what would this federal voting rights bill do about that?
Well, this legislation has been a top priority for the party. It's not new. It was introduced and passed in the House in the last Congress, so this vote this week was a bit of a do-over. They've called it the most sweeping government reform bill since the post-Watergate era, and God, what wouldn't it do? It would do things like allow for automatic voter registration. It would make Election Day a federal holiday. It would restore voting rights to people with past felony convictions. It would also expand early voting that we saw used so much in the 2020 elections. It would also do things like create more independent redistricting commissions to sort of end party-controlled drawing of congressional districts. On campaign finance, it would require more disclosure of big donors. It would require transparency about those ads you see in your social media feeds. And it would create a new public financing system for congressional candidates. It would also do things like expand conflict of interest laws. It would ban members of Congress from serving on corporate boards and require presidents by law to disclose their taxes.
Okay, sweeping, to say the least.
Yeah.
The other bill passed last night is the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Police reform has been a Democratic priority for a long time. What's in this one?
Yeah, this is another bill that passed in the previous Congress, so they're doing it again. This legislation would do things. It would ban chokeholds. It would change so-called qualified immunity protections, so it would make it easier to pursue claims of misconduct against police officers. It would put restrictions on no-knock warrants, and it would require new data collection on police encounters. It would also direct more money to community-based policing programs. This one is not, I mean, it's not as controversial as the voting reforms bill, which has very strong Republican opposition. No Republican supported it. There is a bit more support among Republicans for police reform, especially in the Senate. There's a competing measure by Tim Scott, who's a Republican of South Carolina. So there's maybe a chance there could be more bipartisan effort to move that bill forward. But the other measure is purely a symbolic one at this stage.
Yeah, it's still a tall order. I mean, House Democrats know, based on previous failures, that these bills don't have much hope of getting to 60 votes in the Senate, which, of course, is the magic number to break a filibuster. They would need 10 Republicans to vote with Democrats. So why are they so determined to pass them if the prospects look dim?
Well, part of this is just elections. They're making good on their promises. These issues are very important to the Democratic base, and I think it's about keeping that promise. But you're right. I mean, I think that's going to be one of the core tensions, if not the core tension, of this Congress. I think Democrats are really sensitive to this fact that they control Washington now. They have Congress and the White House, and they want to be able to run in 2022 on accomplishments, but they have these really narrow majorities in the House and Senate, which really limits what they're going to be able to do. You know, it's not just the filibuster, too. The parties are really divided right now. There's not much that they agree on. The bigger picture, though, is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer just doesn't have the votes to change the filibuster, and it's not clear that he ever will in this Congress. One of the biggest opponents is centrist Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He was asked last week if he could ever see changing his mind, and he literally yelled never at the reporters who asked him the question.
Okay, digging in on the filibuster. Sue, just in the moment we have left, we know the Senate is still in session, and they're debating that COVID-19 relief package. What's the latest?
You know, they're making some tweaks to the bill. They've done things like reduce the income limits for people to get those $1,400 stimulus checks. There was concerns among Senate Democrats that too much money was going to people who didn't need it. Otherwise, the bill seems to be on a glide path. They don't expect to get any Republican support, but Democrats seem pretty unified behind it. If it passes this week, they got to send it back over to the House to pass it back over there. But right now, they're on track to meet a March 14th deadline that they've set, which is when current extended unemployment benefits run out, and they don't want to see those benefits lapse. So there's a real pressure campaign to get it done by then.
Okay. That's NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis with the latest. Thanks, Sue.
You're very welcome.
Well, every state in the country is in a race to get the vaccine into the arms of as many residents as possible. And these efforts are in concert with a larger push by President Biden to have vaccines for every American available by the end of May. But new data shows every single state in the country faces at least one significant barrier to getting its residents vaccinated. To unpack this, we have with us Sema Sagayar. And she's CEO of Sergo Ventures and also teaches at Harvard and the University of Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. So let's start with the big picture your research illuminates. Although trouble spots exist all over the U.S., you found the highest levels of concern in the South. Half of counties in southern states have major vaccine roadblocks. A third of counties in western states have problems. And then we see fewer and fewer problems in the Midwest and Northeast. Black, Hispanic, and Native American people are most likely to live in areas where there are major problems. Explain some of the challenges in a place, say, like Alabama, which has the lowest vaccination rate in the country so far.
So in the South, for example, what we see is that the healthcare system is really constrained. What does that mean? That means staffing, infrastructure of the healthcare system is weaker compared to other areas. We also see the quality of the healthcare provider is weaker to other areas.
Mm. Let's go somewhere else in the South, just to lay this out a little bit more. Brantley County in southeastern Georgia was also a place of high concern. What are the problems there, and what are some of the ways a community like that can overcome its vaccination roadblocks?
Yeah, so Brantley County is actually quite interesting. It is a county of really high concern. It scores almost close to one, which means, you know, at the extreme. Where Brantley County really does, you know, really badly is actually going back to those health system factors. And in fact, Brantley County, if you look in within Georgia, it is one of the counties that has had the lowest coverage. Only 3.2% of the population in Brantley County has actually received their vaccinations.
And there are some contrasts. Your map shows a very low level of concern about vaccine roadblocks in Iowa. And yet, to the south of Iowa, there's a very high level of concern about Missouri. What explains this contrast?
Yeah, absolutely. So Missouri is actually not doing so well on many factors, but specifically on poor healthcare access and actually low healthcare resources, as well as historic under-vaccination. So I think the key message here is that even states that are neighboring each other can be very different in terms of how they are, you know, how they're doing on these various themes, which are critical for vaccine coverage. And that really comes back to several things. It comes back to state infrastructure. It comes back to state health spend. It comes back to the underlying composition of the population. But it also, at the end of the day, it all rolls up to the top, and it comes back to state leadership and how are states actually resourcing their healthcare system, and, you know, how are they taking decisions around healthcare in general. So definitely you can see really stark differences between neighboring states depending on you know, the situation of that state and how they're investing.
You call West Virginia, which has been leading on vaccination rates, the unlikely hero of the vaccine rollout. But you make a point to say the state still might be in trouble. How so?
Yeah, West Virginia is really interesting. They've done a phenomenal job in actually getting really high levels of coverage for various reasons, from having a task force to, you know, making sure that vaccines are flooded into local pharmacies. But West Virginia also has two factors, which is really important to keep in mind. It has a large rural population, and we know that rural areas, you know, according to our data, are going to have a harder time. And it also has very poor areas that have issues in terms of linkage and access to healthcare system. And so while in these early phases of the vaccine rollout, which has mostly been targeted to healthcare workers and people in long-term facilities, one thing to keep in mind is that as West Virginia gets to the next phase and you know, gets into the general population, it might really have a hard time in reaching these underserved communities and poorer communities that are living in areas that are hard to reach.
What's the big takeaway here? What lessons can states with possibly greater roadblocks take away from other states that are doing well?
Yeah, I think there's two things I really want to highlight. One is the challenges that different states and counties and communities that will face in rolling out the COVID-19 vaccine is likely going to be different. So it's really about precision and localized response. I think the other one is planning ahead of time but also innovating to solve those solutions, right? So for example, if we have communities that are, you know, very hard to reach or in rural areas, we need to really think about models of how to get the vaccine really to their doorstep rather than trying to ask for our communities to come to us.
You know, what also struck me is this could be useful for everyday citizens to use as a way to kind of see the forest for the trees where they live. Oh, here are the here are the reasons why we're seeing these problems. And maybe being, you know, a voice and getting lawmakers and other leaders to change course.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I think there's a big role that local organizations, whether they're nonprofits or for-profits, can play in this whole endeavor. Mm.
That's Sima Sagayar, CEO and co-founder of the healthcare nonprofit Surgo Ventures. And we will have her data on our website, hereandnow.org. A few Sundays ago, Los Angeles Times columnist Sandy Bakes wrote a piercing article interrogating her previous work, including her reporting on a high-profile case of a young black man sentenced to 40 years in prison. With many states doing away with punitive measures like the Three Strikes Law, Bakes' reflection about her work is part of a larger movement re-examining criminal justice. Sandy Bakes has been a journalist with the LA Times for more than three decades, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
Your recent column looked specifically at your reporting on the case of 19-year-old Brandon Spencer, who was sentenced to 40 years in prison for shooting into a crowd. And when you first wrote about Spencer, you said, quote, pull a gun, go to jail. Spencer didn't kill anyone, but he did receive the minimum sentence because of these gang-related enhancements. Why do you think you initially celebrated this hardline punishment?
I have thought about that a lot, Tanya, and I will tell you when I first looked back at that column, I didn't recognize that person who wrote it. I didn't recognize how harsh I was. But there had been a series of gang shootings, and I'd been writing about them, and there were so many people not involved in gangs who were injured or killed that I think I just was fed up, and I took it out on him. And, you know, when this young man had been first convicted, he had a big, I'll call it a tantrum in the courtroom where he was, you know, pushing the officers and screaming and carrying on. So I was probably also kind of affected by that here's this kid who's not willing to take responsibility. And but yeah, I was really hard on him and felt like that was an appropriate sentence, or at least I seemed to.
How do you perceive Brandon's story today? And maybe how would you approach it differently?
I think, well, I would have liked to be in the courtroom. In this case, I did not, you know, I was not there. And I just was kind of basing my column on our news reports and talking to our reporters. And it made me realize that you can't sit in your newsroom or wherever you are and make judgments in a vacuum. And it was wrong to tie my feelings about this case to what else was going on. But it was also realistic because that is how we perceive things. You know, we perceive things through our own kind of self-interest and what's going on with us and in our lives and the threat to us. So I think what I would have done differently was held off on commenting until I knew more and had talked to more people.
With that, you know, as journalists, we are all having these conversations about myths of objectivity, knowing what we know now. You know, should we, as journalists covering criminal justice, be thinking about that as we interrogate our own biases? What are the questions you're now asking yourself when it comes to this?
You know, I think interrogating our own biases is a great way to put it, because that is what I'm doing. So it's just made me more aware that what I say matters. I mean, you know what I think about now? I think about the parents of Brandon Spencer reading that first column, where I'm basically calling, you know, the son that they worked very hard to raise, and they homeschooled him for a while, and they sent him to relatives in the South when he got in trouble, and they did all this to keep him safe and out of trouble. And to see me in the newspaper, you know, and I'm a black woman, and he's a young black man, and to see me blasting him the way I did, I think a lot about that. So now I realize that we have a tendency to make people into symbols for whatever message we're trying to convey. And that's something that I'm not going to do now, even if it's the easier way or even if I think it's right, because none of this is static, you know, and we're all human beings and capable of change and more complicated than you can see on the surface. So I think it's made me, my editor complains it makes me slow down too much, you know, but that's, I think, is key. And that's one way to get beyond your bias, is to slow down so you can think about, why am I making these judgments? And you know, one thing, Tanya, that shocked me was so many people said, it wasn't what I wrote that mattered, but it was that I said, hey, I was wrong, and I'm sorry. And the feeling that journalists don't do this enough. And that struck me because, you know, I mean, I think we do. I'm a journalist. I think we are as honest as we can be. But it really did make me feel much more accountable, and that our whole profession, you know, is accountable to people, and that we need to be careful and to confess when we're not right.
Yeah. And, you know, an important point to make, because many people who are listening may think, but we can't let criminals off the hook if they've done something wrong. But what I'm hearing from you is a slowing down so that we can get a fuller picture. And this kind of sounds in many ways like reparative journalism. I mean, what does that look like? Is that even possible?
I think, yes, it is possible. It may require a shifting of resources, just like we're defunding police, you know. It may require following cases. Like, what I'd really like to do if I had the time and you know, the support and the energy would be to see what it's like in prison for Brandon Spencer. So to follow someone from a bad choice they made, and talk to the victims. Because I wondered a lot, too. What are those four young people that were shot by Brandon Spencer? What do they think? Mm-hmm. One testified at his trial and said, I don't think he should go to jail. One of them was a kid that he had known since elementary school. And we have to look at, too, why this young man felt like he had to carry a gun. The pressures of growing up in the part of Los Angeles that he did. So I think reparative journalism would be digging more deeply into the cases and the people and their lives. Much as we do, you know, when we cover the opioid crisis, we didn't cover it as a criminal epidemic. We looked at the people and how their lives were affected. And we never did that with crack cocaine. It was always just, you know, here's some criminals that need to be locked up. So I think it's a holistic change that we have to make as a profession and as a society. And I hope that there's an appetite for that now.
That's Sandy Banks, columnist for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tanya. I enjoyed it.
You may not have heard much about the Southeast Alaska fishing town of Pelican this past year, or the indigenous Aleutian Island village of Atka. That's because they're some of the few Alaskan communities that have made it so far without a single confirmed case of COVID-19. And as Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, some of those communities have vaccinated enough people to be close to herd immunity.
If you fly into the Bering Sea Island village of St. Paul right now, a van will meet you at the airport, says Amos Filimonov, president of the island's tribal government.
The driver's all decked out in, you know, a white suit, mask, gloves, the whole nine yards, and he delivers you to whatever house or facility you're going to be locked down in for 2 weeks.
That's right, a mandatory 14-day quarantine. The island is not messing around with COVID-19. At one point, Filimonov says, a charter plane full of seafood processing workers arrived unannounced. They were returned to their boat on the back of a flatbed truck. While some residents of urban Alaska communities have mounted angry resistance to local health mandates, Filimonov says that's not happening in St. Paul.
I haven't had anybody calling me up, you know, saying that this is too restrictive or this is BS or anything like that. It's just, yeah, people have been complying.
With 500 residents, St. Paul is one of Alaska's largest communities with zero confirmed coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. And roughly half of its adult population has been vaccinated. But it's far from unique in Alaska.
Everybody claims that it's so hard to get in and out of here. I say, that's perfect. There is no better time to be stranded in what people call the middle of nowhere, because I call it heaven.
Walt Weller is mayor of the tiny and famously remote Southeast Alaska fishing town of Pelican, which is more than half vaccinated and has also seen zero confirmed cases among its 75 residents. For years, Pelican's leaders have objected to cuts to state-sponsored ferry service, but Weller acknowledges a months-long gap in visits last year probably helped keep the virus out. He says the island town has taken COVID-19 seriously, closing some buildings and encouraging hand washing and mask wearing, but he attributes most of Pelican's success to its isolation.
Half the people here almost never left here anyway. They're not going to have you tell them that they're not going to go over to grandma's house, which they do have done every Sunday their whole lives, okay?
Alaska has at least 10 communities that have made it through a full year of COVID with no cases. And there are likely more, as the state health department won't release data about villages with fewer than 1,000 people, citing privacy considerations. Many of the communities like Pelican and St. Paul are on islands or otherwise hard to get to. Many have adopted strict travel and other health mandates, with some community leaders citing lingering memories of how the 1918 flu pandemic devastated Alaska's indigenous population. Another layer of protection came in strict rules from the state, which up until last month required COVID-19 testing for all visitors to Alaska. Dr. Ann Zink, Alaska's chief medical officer, says she thinks there's also a degree of luck involved.
But we also know that mitigation strategies work, and it's been pretty amazing to see some of these smaller communities work incredibly close together and collaboratively to be able to keep COVID out of their communities and what that does to protect elders and to protect others.
Zink says she's always worried about declaring victory too early, but she acknowledges that some of the communities with no COVID cases might actually be nearing that point, as vaccination rates in some places have hit as high as 90% of adults. On St. Paul, Filimonov, the tribal president, says residents aren't letting their guard down. He says discussions are starting about the summertime and whether it can be safe for tourists to visit, maybe as part of a closed bubble. In the meantime, there's no escaping the need for hand sanitizer.
Never seen so many damn dispensers for hand wash in my life, but they're everywhere. And, you know, it's learning to live the new normal. And well, I hope that someday soon this thing is just like the flu.
For now, St. Paul residents are sticking to social distancing and wearing masks in public buildings, too, Filimonov says. For Here Now, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
Bill Magness, the CEO of the Texas Power Grid System, ERCOT, has been fired for his handling of last month's deadly blackouts that left more than 4 million people without power in the state. The board of directors voted yesterday to remove Magness, and this news comes after the state's Public Utility Commission chairwoman, Deanne Walker, resigned on Monday. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
So ERCOT's board said in the meeting that they'll begin an immediate search for Magness's replacement. But first, explain exactly what happened. What do we know about the details of his removal from the board?
Well, so obviously there was a lot of outrage and demand for accountability over what happened in Texas. I mean, after all, dozens of lives were lost. There was something like $129 billion worth of economic losses. There were people, regular customers, getting power bills for thousands of dollars. So obviously a lot of that outrage was focused squarely on ERCOT and the CEO, Magness, for making the decision to turn off the power to millions of people, which he defended as sort of the best way to preserve the entire grid so the whole state didn't lose power for a longer time. And Tanya, obviously there's a lot of finger pointing going on, and there's a case to be made that the way in which Texas deregulated its power grid, it was perhaps doomed to something like this. But when you're demanding accountability, it's hard to sort of get past the guy leading the power grid. So I think, you know, it was clear from his testimony to the Texas state legislature that people wanted to see some accountability, and that starts at the top.
Yeah, and we actually have some sound from Magness when he was questioned by the Texas Senate. Let's listen.
I guess I wouldn't say it's a failure, you know.
Mr. Magness, with all due respect, yeah.
this is not a Chamber of Commerce update. This is the largest train wreck in the history of deregulated electricity.
That was Texas Senator Brandon Creighton responding to Magnus. And to your point, what you were saying, I mean, it's a bigger issue here. We know that many people are still trying to recover, though, from this disaster. How will ERCOT actually come back from this? Can they be trusted after this massive power outage?
Well, I think the entire industry in Texas, both the plants that actually generate the electricity, as well as the plants that supply the natural gas and the wind and other forms of energy to the generating plants, they're all basically preparing for stricter rules that will require them to retrofit their plants to handle harsher winter than perhaps they were expecting. Yeah, but as far as trust, it's going to be tough. And I think a lot of people in Texas, my joke is that it's probably a good time to be a salesman of backup generators in Texas, because I think people are not going to trust them for a while until they get this sorted out.
Mm-hmm. Magnus has 60 days left as CEO of ERCOT. Do we know who they're considering for this position?
Yeah, so my colleagues here at Bloomberg are reporting that the leading candidate is a guy named Brad Jones. He's the former head of New York's power grid. He's also a Texan, and he was once the chief operating officer of ERCOT. So they have people familiar with the situation saying that he, for the moment at least, is the leading candidate for the job.
Yeah, but there's still so much here and so much to follow, as you said. That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. As always, thank you so much, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Tanya.
U.S. Capitol Police are ramping up security at the complex today, concerned about a possible plot by a militia group to breach the building. The threat is connected to a baseless conspiracy theory that former President Donald Trump will rise to power again on March 4th, which used to be Inauguration Day. This comes just 2 months after pro-Trump rioters stormed the Capitol in a failed insurrection. For more, we're joined by Ben Collins, who covers disinformation, extremism, and the Internet for NBC News. Ben, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And so, Ben, the FBI and Homeland Security are warning about online chatter among extremist groups discussing plans to take over the Capitol on March 4th, today. So what's so significant about this date?
Well, after the 6th and the 20th in January, QAnon supporters kind of ran out of ideas, basically. So they went diving, really. And they found March 4th, which in the sovereign citizen movement means something. Sovereign citizens are basically tax evaders. They're, you know, decades-old conspiracy theorists who believe that the United States government hasn't been legitimate since Ulysses S. Grant was president in the 1800s. He was inaugurated on March 4th in 1869, and they don't believe that there's been a legitimate government since then. Now, QAnon supporters, they're not all the way in on this, right? They don't really fully believe all this stuff, but they're desperate for some sort of answer that isn't Joe Biden as the president and reality is reality. So there has been chatter around this date in the last few weeks and months, but they've since then sort of tried to pull back, realizing that there are no events scheduled. There are no big rallies scheduled. Last time when they got a date going, you know, the president said, okay, all right, we'll do the 6th. That's not what happened this time. And right now they're kind of reeling.
Well, I think you're getting at an important point, which is you mentioned two other previously important dates. January 6th, of course, was the date of the attempted insurrection. Also January 20th. I mean, it makes me wonder, Ben, that after today passes and Donald Trump doesn't rise to power again, I mean, what comes next for these extremist groups? I mean, do they just give up? Because what it seems like is every time their hopes are dashed, it's actually not a reality check. And instead, they just form a new conspiracy theory around some new date.
Yeah, you know, there was a book from the 70s called When Prophecy Fails, which followed a specific cult that had a doomsday, and that doomsday passed. And it followed in real time how these people, they didn't just stop at their doomsday. They said, oh, we must have done something to prevent this. So they become more hardened in their beliefs as time goes on. And that's what's happening with especially the QAnon movement, but also militia movements. They believe that this is an ongoing struggle, that maybe Donald Trump wasn't the best conduit for their struggle.
Well, the unwillingness to give up on these ideas, even amid failed prophecies, might help explain why this is such a persistent problem. Because earlier this week, we heard from the FBI director, Christopher Wray. He told the Senate Judiciary Committee that the Capitol riot was the culmination of a domestic terror threat that's been growing for years. Here's what he said.
Unfortunately, As you noted, Mr. Chairman, January 6th was not an isolated event. The problem of domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country for a long time now, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Now, Ray also confirmed that after Black Lives Matter demonstrations over the summer, the FBI did increase its focus on anti-government extremists like Antifa, but still listed that below the threat posed by white supremacists. And yet I wonder, Ben, I mean, is it possible that the agency got distracted by political pressure from the Trump administration, and that's why white supremacists were able to gain power seemingly in the shadows?
Absolutely, yes. You know, part of these same groups that were at the Capitol were the ones staging these fights that were fighting against Black Lives Matter protesters in the streets. They were planning these things in the Pacific Northwest all throughout the summer. And the president, Donald Trump, at that time, was okay with this. You know, he said, stand back and stand by to the Proud Boys. He could have told these people to go away and to cut it out, but he did not do that. You know, these people were strategically aligned with the previous White House. And that's really what these investigations are looking into. You know, that's the unspoken thing here, is how much did the president know? How much was he okay with these people fomenting insurrection and then eventually following through with it?
So I want to ask Ben more about what we do to deal with it, because there's been some reporting in recent days that some of these far-right groups who were part of the Capitol riot, like the Proud Boys, are starting to splinter. They're having divisions within their ranks. And on its face, that might seem like a good thing. But the other side of that is that it raises the concern that there are going to be lone extremists who can be more difficult to track. Can you explain that risk?
Yeah, this is always sort of the issue with, you know, people are talking about deplatforming of extremists, you know, QAnon not being allowed on Twitter, or white supremacist groups not being allowed to congregate on Facebook and, you know, spread their messages there. It is a double-edged sword, right? Those people are not allowed to recruit into more normal spaces, into more civilian spaces. If the Proud Boys aren't allowed on Facebook, you know, they have to go to Telegram. Not everybody's grandma's on Telegram. They're not going to be able to get their message out in the same way. However, when those people go into these smaller spaces, these spaces that are not tracked as easily, it's harder to find out what they're actually planning.
And understanding the members of these groups strikes me as a challenging task, Ben, both for you as a reporter and for law enforcement. I mean, many are committing illegal and hateful acts. Without minimizing that, it's also the case that some have been taken advantage of. They've been lied to by people in power. So how do we reconcile those two things?
Yeah, it's really difficult. You know, QAnon is a really good example of this, because QAnon is based on this incredibly violent ideology, right? It's based on the premise that all of these people will be rounded up and killed, and everyone will be rooting for it and cheering for it. There will be a gallows. All of these public figures who we know will be murdered in public. That is the end game of QAnon. And that sounds really horrific. That sounds like a terror cell, and that's what it is. But it is wrapped up a lot of American churches, a lot of American grandmas and grandfathers who have no intention of actually committing violence. So, you know, separating those two things is really difficult. A lot of these people are rooting this on like it's a TV show or a serialized book series or something like that, like a Da Vinci Code sort of thing. They think they're getting codes on the internet and that at the end of it, there will be a season finale. Those people are not terrorists, but they are falling into lockstep with a bunch of people who are spouting terrorist ideology. It is really difficult right now for law enforcement to find out what's real and what's a guy just joking around on the internet.
Ben, you know, last June, you spoke with my colleague Robin Young about how you had tried to warn Facebook and other social media companies that the spread of violent extremism on those platforms was really getting pretty ugly. And there's a moment in that conversation that has stuck with me because I can hear the emotion in your voice. And so I want to play some of that. Here you are speaking with Robin 9 months ago.
A few weeks ago, I called Facebook and I said, look, I hate being right about this stuff. If you guys don't step up, you and YouTube specifically, if you guys don't step up here, it's going to get really bad really quickly. And they didn't. It is it's devastating to consistently know what's next in this beat. I'm sorry for talking like this, but it's a recurring nightmare that you just get used to, unfortunately.
So, Ben, reflect on those words. I mean, do you see social media companies taking the threat of extremism more seriously since then, or do you continue to see your worst fears realized?
The good news is, since then, a lot of these companies have taken a lot more seriously. The context around that conversation was, there was a guy who had murdered a federal officer, a Boogaloo boy, He had murdered a federal officer, and then I called Facebook because I knew it was getting bad in these Boogaloo spaces. And in between that phone call and that murder, he had killed another person. This guy was on the lam. And all of these groups were still up. This guy had planned this on Facebook and Facebook Messenger and in Facebook groups and Boogaloo groups. And they were just up. They were up on the website, available to the public. And they had told me, like, we're making these really narrow distinctions about what's a terror group. And they were doing it to make it so they didn't have to take action against this widespread domestic terror problem they had on their platform. And those distinctions have gone away because I think they realize now that they can abet insurrection. They can abet domestic terror by being a central organizing cog. And they've sort of thrown down the hammer on these groups that had really no differentiation from groups like ISIS, except for the fact that they were American in nature. They used irony as a sort of disguise. And they were mostly white people. And that has changed in the last few months. They are never going to atone for the stuff that they've done. And they're never going to admit that they were, you know, the primary driver of a lot of these problems. But they have gotten better.
Well, it's good to hear that. And I think your story, though, underscores that your beat can be painful, but also very important. And we appreciate your doing it. Ben Collins covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. We'll link listeners to your reporting at hereandnow.org. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kyle.
The pandemic has disrupted a lot of programs that keep kids occupied and out of trouble, and that's a problem in areas where violent crime is going up. Marco Seiler Gonzalez from member station KQED takes us to Oakland, California, where students there are coming to grips with the loss of a football standout and how sports might have been able to save his life.
The Oakland Unified School District just started allowing their sports teams to work out for the first time in nearly a year.
Y'all got cleats? Throw them on. Throw them on. Let's go. You throw your cleats on. As soon as that gate opens, we drop your bag. Let's hit the field.
Joe Bates is the head football coach at Skyline High School. He's standing with 30 or so players and coaches outside of an athletic field in East Oakland. As the gate opens, the students run onto the field and splinter out into their positions for drills. It's a lot of young, lanky kids lining up 6 feet apart, awaiting the coach's cue.
That first 5 yards got to be the hardest burst. Sit. Go.
Unlike a normal practice, there's no balls, no pads, and no contact. Defensive coach Kerry Griffin says the important thing is just getting the kids back on the field.
So that way they're not always cooped up in the house or running the streets.
It's well known the COVID-19 pandemic has hit Black and Latino neighborhoods particularly hard. But a different epidemic has taken a violent grip over those same communities as school programs have disappeared.
It's way more shootings than it used to be.
Devin Trahan is a defensive tackle in his senior year at Skyline. He lives just down the street from the athletic field where he says shootings have become a near daily occurrence. Before the pandemic, Oakland's violent crime was on the decline. But the murder rate increased by 36% in 2020, according to Oakland Police. The school district says around 12 students and recent graduates were a part of that death toll. One of those students was an up-and-coming star running back for Skyline, Aaron Pryor. He was shot and killed back in September, just after turning 16.
If Corona wouldn't have never hit, I think my son would have still been here, for sure. It's no ifs, ands, buts about it. He would have still been here.
Taiwan Pryor is Aaron's dad. I meet him at his house in East Oakland, where he's sitting outside with friends and family. He's wearing a black long-sleeve shirt with a blown-up picture of him with his son.
That was my number one guy. I was his number one fan.
Aaron's football career started at a young age, when his dad put him in a Pop Warner youth league.
He had some awesome talent, bro. He was MVP for like 2 years in a row. Feel me? Aaron was running back all 4 years.
Pryor moved to Las Vegas when Aaron was 13, and his son's life outside of the game became more complicated. Aaron lived with his mom, but she worked long hours. His dad says that's when Aaron started getting into trouble. Aaron was arrested for robbery when he was 14 years old and spent 9 months in juvie. It's there that Pryor says his son had a big wake-up call.
And he was like, damn, Dad, like I'm supposed to be playing football right now. So that really hurt him, that he couldn't play.
Pryor moved back to Oakland to keep a closer eye on his son. After Aaron got out of juvie, Pryor took him to see Coach Bates, who saw Aaron's potential. Aaron started to meet with teammates for unofficial workouts in the park last spring. But just as he was getting into rhythm with his team, the pandemic got worse and they stopped working out together. Aaron fell back into old habits on the streets.
If you don't get away, or if you don't really be focused, then just Oakland is a big old trap, man, for certain kids. And my son was one of them.
While the virus is a very real threat, some public health experts say it has to be weighed against other public health concerns, like gun violence. John Swartzberg is a professor at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. He says it's a matter of harm reduction. The idea is that it's unrealistic to expect kids to stay indoors all day. So provide an outdoor space where they can stay safe from the virus and out of harm's way.
The harm reduction would be to say, well, yes, there is a risk of doing that, but the good that comes from it is better, and it's going to help obviate them from doing other things.
Unlike opening schools for in-person learning, which can be costly, the cost of opening outdoor conditioning programs is relatively inexpensive. A spokesman for the school district acknowledged that the absence of sports is detrimental for students, but he said the district was more focused on reopening classrooms, which haven't opened yet. Meanwhile, the state has allowed for outdoor conditioning since July. Coach Bates says he tried to keep tabs on Aaron and believes that had the district reopened sports much earlier, Aaron might still be alive.
And when it happened, we felt broken because, you know, we felt the responsibility to a certain extent, you know what I mean? And we felt like we failed.
Coach Bates says it's hard to keep some students engaged in remote learning without football. He's had 3 kids drop out since the pandemic hit, and 22 others who are falling behind in their classes. For the time being, the coaching staff at Skyline High School is just happy to have their boys back on the field. At the end of practice, Coach Bates leads the team in a rallying cry. The chant is also a big part of their official game time hype song. For Here and Now, I'm Marco Seiler Gonzalez in Oakland.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now. People saying that it's cutthroat. When you smack them, you put them in the